And then you can take those corrections and put them in. You don't have to do that. I find about that helps me distinguish who's interested in the paper from who's not interested. But, you know, you're you, and that's you're who you are. So that's really where the grade comes from. I'm really into video recently, so you're going to make some kind of iMovie project. Any of you ever done an iMovie or the equivalent on a PC? I mean, you can sit down in front of a Mac now. It's got a camera right in it. It's got a tape recorder. You could read some lines, right? You could read God's prohibition to Adam, and you can read Achilles' anger at Agamemnon, and, you know, something like that. That'd be fun. And kind of, because this is literature class, it's meant to be fun, believe it or not. Okay? But it's a reading class, you know, we're doing literature, so the study hint, is it the study hint? Where do I say the, well, anyway, you need the book. Without the book, you're lost here. This is a book class. I don't want to hear from you, all right? If you don't have the book, don't show up. I mean, because this is a book class. You can't go to the library and get all these things. All this stuff's available, but it's just too much trouble to start coordinating pages. So we get all we get the same book, the Norton Anthology, Anthology of Western Literature. 8th edition, 7th is no good. Believe me, I have to redo all my pages. It's a bigger pain for me than it is for you. But we're on the 8th edition, all right? And I saw 7 copies left in University Bookstore yesterday. I haven't been to Follett's, but I assume they're out there. Cost $65, but if I ordered this stuff separately, believe me, it'd be a couple of hundred. So, and this has got pretty decent introductions. It's not a hardback, but these guys are the top of the line these days. They even have color pictures. Remind me about this one right away. Any questions? I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. What's missing on the syllabus? What's the big question? By the way, is it hot out there? In this room? They put 35 of you in here. Okay, so you can bring your fans. I don't care. I wouldn't bring too much food because it gets knocked over, you know. And bring a handkerchief for those big sneezes. Right? I don't know what they taught you in nursery school, but it's a good idea, right? Should always carry a handkerchief. Just for the person next to you. If you got to leave the room in the middle of the class, go leave the room, come back. If you're late, try not to be late, but if you're late, come anyway. All right? Still, what's missing? So, no? What?
Attendance.
Yeah, the attendance policy. So what should we have for an attendance policy? Well, I'm getting old. if you're not here, you're dead. That's all I got to say. But I'm not going to be the one to kill you. You can shoot yourself in the head. So I don't have an attendance policy. You're all adults. You know when you really have to be somewhere else. You know I'm not going to be too happy making it up for you. I'm going to try and tape the classes. Okay. I got this little gizmo, but I find it's about 75% effective. I start jumping around. I hit the wrong button. The battery goes out. Believe me, it's just not that great. I got a new tape recorder for my iPod, but I lost it already. Between Christmas and now, huh? Not bad. I got the iPod, but I lost the little gizmo that turns it into a tape recorder. But I may find it. All right. This is okay. You got to bring the book, and we read through it. And you mark passages, and those are the ones that show up on the exams. And it's that simple, all right? And I got some big thoughts occasionally. I'm not that smart, but I have occasional big thought. And I pass it on to you, and I want to hear it back during the exam, all right? Now, I don't want to crimp anybody's freedom. You want to take the book, go off on your own, come back and take the exams, that's fine, all right? But it's a pretty big book, all right? So showing up in class is really the way to do it. And I notice a lot of people don't take notes. They just sit there. It doesn't work. All right. Pretend this is like law school or something. When you get to law school, you'll notice everybody takes notes like crazy. All right. Because it's too expensive not to. So I really recommend you. Does anybody like have a pencil? A pen? You know? Right. Okay. So you want to bring one of those little guys and bring some paper. And if I'm not, my feelings aren't hurt if you transfer out of the class, believe me, cool off the room a little bit, all right? But this stuff is really great. It's, you know, it's been around for 2,000 years. It's not like the third episode of Scrubs, a show I like, okay? Okay, you know, but I'm not sure we'll be, showing it in 2,000 years, okay? So this stuff, we will be, all right? We go from the beginnings as far back as we can get, and we get up to about 1670. The last week's a little hazy in my foresight, you can see that. But I'd like to get up to Milton's Paradise Lost, which really ends the epic tradition. Okay? What else do I got to tell you? The things... I mean, these texts teach us how to read them, all right? We are sitting here in Indiana in 2007, and these things are different. They're different from you and me, all right? So we look through and we see what they're talking about, all right? So it takes us out of ourselves into another world and reminds us that practically everything we do right here is pretty contingent, too. And we don't have the answers today, as everybody's starting to realize. I'll put this on tape so you can sue me, but for 5 years, I haven't mentioned The Rock in a class, but now that everybody hates the president, it's probably more open. And the first thing we're going to do today is start in Babylon. Do you know where Babylon is? Has anybody ever heard of Mesopotamia? Yeah, some of you have a Sunday school background, so you know these things. Well, we're starting right in Iraq, which is pretty fascinating, but just coincidence, all right? More than anything else. But I hope, how many of you have read this, by the way? Do you know what this is? The Iraq Report? I mean, I gotta admit, I was one of those guys, you know, gung-ho, go in, take about, stuff like that. So, but this is pretty interesting. As Americans today, you owe yourself to read it. This was written by James Baker, right? President Bush's father's best friend, Henry Kissinger's number two guy. Sandra Day O'Connor, Republican Supreme Court Justice. These are like serious people, all right? Just give me a number between 1 and 72. You're going to get a big speech today. I notice you guys are here and not in Iraq, by the way. What? 59. The Iraqi government should provide funds to expand and upgrade communications equipment and motor vehicles for the Iraqi police service. Now, when was the last time you heard anybody ask on a news conference, say, what about number 59? That's all I want to hear. You know, show me the bills for that communications equipment. Anyway, all right, so that's all you get on this. I have something new in this class. It's not just reading. Last summer I did a project on world literature, videotaping different people in the English department and the foreign language department. And we sort of moved around the world. And I'm trying to figure out how to make it part of the course, all right? And I haven't figured it out yet. I'm having a meeting with the head of the Purdue Press tomorrow. So right now it's just an adjunct thing. I just think it sort of livens things up. But I want you to, during the course, besides reading this stuff, I'm going to want you to look at all these videos. Now, I originally designed them so that if I was feeling bored or I hadn't done the reading, I could show up in class with, you know, unprepared and just show a video. But I think that's a bad way to teach. Actually, it gets us back to the attendance policy, okay? You know, you expect me to be here, I expect you to be here. The other side of that, if I'm doing so badly that you don't want to show up, you know, that's a good way to, you know. I think attendance policies are bad because it makes the teacher lazy. So I'd like to have you here voluntarily, okay, but I must admit it's pretty hard to take the exams unless you've been here. But if you like listening to tapes and you trust the tape, that's your business. But I do respond to those little smiles and stuff and the little wave, you know, that I know you're here every day too, right? So I guess the downside, if you show up, it does not guarantee you an A. But if you come up to me and I don't know who you are, or if you haven't been here, don't send me the email and say, what do I need to do to get an A in the class? Right? It's right on the syllabus. You get an A on an exam, you get an A on the final, you get an A on a paper. If you don't do that, you're out. Okay, the B's will come, and only one or two of you will get C's. But you have to work hard to do that. All right. So anyway, you go to this web page. This is not what I'm not. Well, I may do it. You know, you'll know. I'm not prepared when I bring the video out. Okay, but if you go to this, then you can. My web page is boyardo.com. It's mentioned about 5 times in the syllabus, and that's just a page I use. I pay some service. It's my own homepage, and Purdue doesn't tell me what to do with that, so I can't shut it down, and I can't data mine it. All right, because by the way, you're all being data mined, right? You don't know it till you get this. We got an email once about last year saying they had to search everybody's emails to see if you were using students' social security numbers. That let me know that they could read every single email I write. Okay. You too. If you're using Purdue. Anyway, this is the boyardo.com site, and you go to First Lines, and here we go. And you can see that I've made videotapes. We're starting Genesis in about half an hour. And we have Professor Sandy Goodhart, who teaches Bible as Literature here, discussing the first lines. I may actually show a little of this today, okay? But we'll see what happens. But if I don't, when you go home, I think you should look at these things. They're really fun. I realize that people don't like to sit in front of their terminal for 20-minute video clips, right? But here, I'll show you how it works. But it's worth it, because they actually build up to something. This is a class. It's kind of an educational thing. So it takes a minute to download. You have to be pretty much on a seriously wired system for this to work, okay, with QuickTime 7 in your computer. Any campus, not all the campus computers will have that. So. What I would like is for you to... somehow we're going to do little projects. Somehow everybody's going to get to recite in different languages. And I had a great theory. See, I learned some Hebrew, learned some Greek, learned some Chinese. We're going to do a little Tang Dynasty to make, you know, to give this a world literature instead of a Western literature. And I did these last summer, and by God, I can't remember a word of Chinese. It's just my whole theory shot. It's so hard. Okay, it's really short. So I don't know. So you're kind of a test case for me. So I'll see if I can get you. You're young and strong. Maybe you can remember some of this stuff. All right.
I went out walking through streets paved with gold. Lifted some stones for the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye. Yeah, I went with nothing but the thought of you. I went wandering.
Can you see? see that right there?
It's poetry.
What makes it poetry?
Well,
tell me the Bereshit.
Here's the Bereshit right there.
So the first word is Bereshit.
Can we start from?
What does that mean?
Right to left.
Bereshit.
It's the first word.
All right. It does not mean in the beginning.
It doesn't.
Not mean in the beginning.
I knew you were going to become.
Yeah, I knew it too.
In the beginning, God created the heaven.
Yeah, right. That's that.
Okay, so we got problems right from the first word. Right? But I think it's really interesting, and he gets going, so he's worth watching for 20 minutes. So what I want to do today is just sort of, if you don't have any questions, anybody, I'm going to jump right in. I figured a lot of you weren't going to have the book. So I Xeroxed a couple of pages. If you don't have any other paper, just scribble on that. And because trying to get 2,000 years into one semester, not so easy. So we got to get through a couple of works here. Excuse me?
Are there extra pages?
Did we run out? There must have been lots. If you have a book, you don't need the pages. Okay. Well, generally, in a course like this, the first thing one read was Greek literature or Hebrew literature. And in the last 30 years, people are trying to decenter the influence of the Bible or the Greeks. And instead of looking at all this stuff in terms of Western culture, now we like to look at it in terms of world culture. Right? And there is a big world out there. And there's really interesting stuff. And but I got to tell you, it pretty much even the rest of the world comes down to Western culture these days. If you're I got a lot of graduate students from China, and they write about Chinese novels, but they are reading Charles Dickens, okay, or Virginia Woolf, and that's where the Chinese novel of the 20th century comes from. It does not come from Confucius. There's no Confucius in this edition, so I'm sorry about that. But what we have is this little item called Gilgamesh. So I want to talk about that. That's essentially our beginning. What does that word mean? Ever heard of of the Chaldees? Doesn't Abraham go visit him in the Bible? You are. Means in the beginnings. It seems to have been a city in Babylon. So I'm going to look at... what did I Xerox for you? Pages 2 and 3? All right. In this course, we're going to do the ancient world. We start in Babylon, we do Greece, we do Rome, essentially the Mediterranean base, and then we kind of move to the Middle Ages, which focuses much more on Western Europe. Right? And then by the end of the course, we're in the Renaissance, right, which is even more local, pretty much Italy and England and France. All right? So that'd be the three big movements here. Because of our debt to world literature, I've thrown in some Chinese poetry. This edition, the Norton anthologies have been changing a lot, and this is, believe me, actually more convenient than the thing they had before, which was in three volumes, and it was a real pain in the neck. And it had a huge section on Egyptian poetry, which may be good, but I couldn't figure it out. And nobody I could talk to could figure it out. And it's hard enough to figure out this Gilgamesh. But you all know ancient Egypt because they built pyramids. But they just weren't a literary culture. Right? So in this course, we really look at literary cultures. Not every culture's got a literature. Right? Some cultures don't have literature. Some cultures have music. Some cultures have dance. Some have sculpture. Some have art. Some build cars. I think if you define culture as the dominant thing in a society, you know, you could say, well, what's the culture of America today? And I would say, cars. You know, I mean, that's it. I mean, they're really everywhere. You don't think about it, but... And the rest of the world is catching up, but we are a car country, all right? I mean, you everything revolves around a car. And to not have a driver's license is like a death sentence, all right? Anyway, there are literary cultures where you just sit around and read books, right? You don't need a car. Maybe you have a horse, something like that. Anyway, so we're back to the ancient world. And I'm going to start on page one here and just... go through it a little bit. I have my own things, but I was reading this last night and I decided to stick with the text. It makes it easier for you to review and I can sort of tail off when I feel like it. All right. Anyway, their literature, as they say here, came in three forms: Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Hebrew, Greek, Latin. You just saw Stanley start with the Hebrew. So I want to get that across to you. You know, I mean, it's hard for me to know what's too simple and what's too complicated. I mean, you are, when you get done with this class, you're going to be so different from everybody else that you know. It's going to be weird. I mean, what are there, 35 of you here in a university of 35,000 people? You know, I mean, I go up to President Jisky and says, you know, that Tang Dynasty stuff's pretty good Chinese. I mean, he just looks at me like, what's that got to do with cars? Yeah. Right. I mean, people don't know. Right? I had a friend, otherwise smart woman, all right, her boyfriend, I mean, she's 40 years old, took her to Brazil. 40 years old, did not know they speak Portuguese in Brazil. Well, maybe you don't know either, but that's pretty big. Okay, there's this thing called Spanish, and they speak it down in Mexico and South America, but there's Portuguese in Brazil. Right, so they're different languages and they're different cultures. There's this thing called Arabic out there. Number 64 in this report. When they wrote this in October, there were 1,000 people in the green zone in Iraq. 1,000 people working for the Americans, doing various things. 11 had any Arabic at all. 11 people. 6 could be said to speak it after 5 years. Okay. They weren't too happy. This is an unbelievable document. Whack! Whack, whack, whack. Here, you've done this wrong, you've done that wrong. Anyway, so we want to try and break through that facade. Well, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin were the major languages, all right? And they all come together at the end of the first paragraph there. That one name I want to point out, in the figure of St. Augustine. Have you heard of St. Augustine? If you haven't, you'll hear of him now. All right? St. Augustine essentially invented Christianity as you know it today, as America knows it. All right? It does not come straight out of the Bible. It's blended with Greek influences, and it's highly Romanized. And we're going to try and figure out what that means. But St. Augustine was the Einstein of the ancient world. Right? And the selection is pitifully small in this book, but we want to keep that in mind, that there was a thing shaped as Roman culture, and Augustine's really the figure. In other words, he really put together Christianity as you know it, and there's more to be said about that. Down at the bottom of this page, it says, it talks about the Fertile Crescent. You got a nice little map here of the... I don't have it on the. It's you ever heard of the Fertile Crescent? This area in the Middle East, and it says the Fertile Crescent is Iraq and Iran, which is crazy because it's actually Syria too. I mean, that's what makes it a crescent. You come up the Mediterranean, you know, through Israel today, and up through Syria, and you go around the mountains in the bottom of Turkey. Right, and then out into eastern Iraq, where the Iraq flatlands hits the Iranian plateau. Right, you know, Iran is up higher than Iraq. Iraq is flat down in the desert, and any time you get up, you're either up in the southern Turkey or you're in Persia. These are things that people used to know, and we're going to sort of read about them. The Persia has always been a separate people. They're fairly racially distinct from the Arabic populations. Iranians today go back to the ancient Persians, to trace back to 2500 AD. We're not going to do any Persian poetry, but I got a little in the first lines. When you get to the Turkish part, you'll get some somebody talking about ancient Persian poetry, which is really interesting stuff. It just seems to me people should know this stuff. There's this notion that the Shiites of Persia today are going to combine with the Shiites of southern Iraq, and it ain't ever going to happen. They may have the same religion, but they're completely different people, and they're just, the Persians are Persians, or Iranians, and the Iraqis are Arabs, and they just are distinct, and they're not going to join forces suddenly and conquer the world, so that's not really a good reason to be over there. All right. Now, the Persians have been around for a long time. They made their imprint two times, or a couple of times, mainly when they tried to invade Greece, and the ancient Greeks, by fighting off the Persian advances, established themselves as a civilization. We'll get into that a bit. All right, now to the passage you have on page 2 and 3. The very first sentence, we have this word hieroglyphic. Again, some of you get this in Sunday school, but what's a hieroglyph? Right? It's what? Yeah, symbol, right? Picture writing. Okay, and you find it in on Egyptian pyramids. I'm doing this fast, all right? And on obelisks, these stone things that the Egyptians made, and you can find, there's one in Central Park in New York, there's one in front of St. Peter's in Rome. These were highly prized. There's one in London. I don't know where the others are. Maybe one in Paris. I'm sure they'll want them back eventually. Okay, but they have little, picture writing and stuff, and usually talk about the god Ramses and something like that. All right. Well, that's not writing. All right. But writing develops in the period we're looking at, and just quickly, it's by 500 BC you have writing in Greek. Okay, and the first stuff that's written down is Homer, and that actually goes back, they say, probably to the 8th century B.C. All right? But right about roughly the same time, the Hebrew is getting written down too. So you have this kind of big thing that happens somehow. Right? And the Hebrew is really interesting because, around 500 B.C. was the Babylonian captivity. When the Hebrews were dragged out of modern Palestine and over to, guess where, Mesopotamia, somewhere around Baghdad, all right, and spent a miserable 70 years. And Jeremiah prophesied, and eventually they got back. But when they came back, they were writing. Okay, somewhere in that period, during the exile, the writing started. And it's paralleled by the developments in ancient Greece, roughly this period. Now it turns out that there was some massive change happened around 1200. And this is basically the period of the Trojan War, when Homer sets the Trojan War. And the civilization he refers to, they're clearly very good making metal, gold and bronze. And this is what sort of freaks people out. You see the ancient Egyptian gold. It's real stuff. This isn't fake. Right? And they uncovered in Mycenae, a Greek city, they uncovered a real treasure trove of gold. And they have equivalents up in Britain. Right? So gold metallurgy, really exquisite stuff. Gold is a soft metal, can be made. You can make good jewelry out of it. Okay. And gold metallurgy precedes the writing. So we know there's a civilization that has this stuff. Okay, but we don't know anything really about them because something devastated everything. Some guy, some war, something happened. And there's a real break between 1200 and 500. And your text refers to it as the kind of dark ages. Right. There are wonderful videotapes on this stuff in the library. I don't have time to show them here, but if you get the tapes on Homer, the history around Homer, they're absolutely fascinating. All I can do is say, it not only was gold, though, there was some form of writing. And that's where this Gilgamesh kicks in. All right? And that's why we're looking at it. It changes things because it, and the, what your book is, stresses is, you know, in the Bible, in Genesis, there's a flood, right? God sends flood down because he's angry at man, and you're going to read the Noah passage for Thursday, right? Well, guess what? In the Gilgamesh, there's also a flood, and this thing's written like 2,000 years before the Hebrew text is written down. All right, so it kind of suggests that God just didn't hand down this little bunch of stories in Genesis, that these were part of a floating literature that was out there. Right? Your text sets this out pretty well. I'm just sketching it here. So let's think about Babylon. Well, the idea that Baghdad might flood, or anywhere on the Euphrates or Tigris River, is not like mind-blowing. It's fine. I mean, Lafayette floods. Okay? And that, well, a flood's a flood. A river goes over its boundaries and it floods. The Nile flooded all the time until they built the Aswan Dam in what year? 1959. Opened up. Built by the Russians. Height of the Cold War. Right? So, you know, the Nile used to flood and then recede, and you had the fertile area that was left. Well, the Tigris and Euphrates clearly flood. Any river would flood. The Colorado River would flood in Los Angeles today if we didn't have what dams on the Colorado River? The Hoover Dam. You been to Vegas? No, okay. When you go to Las Vegas, you go visit the Hoover Dam. It's really unbelievable. Example of Art Deco, 1930s Art Deco at its finest. Just like the Empire State Building. You want to see not what this course is about? Okay, back to Babylon. What is there any? Why should we even bother with this little piece of Gilgamesh? All right. Well, because it's written, all right? But it's not written with an alphabet. It's written in this thing called cuneiform, and it wasn't until these are words I want you to know. I want you to know what hieroglyph is. You know, when you see cuneiform on the old exam, you say, ah, Babylonian writing. Basically, they use wedges. There's little wedges signs. I have no idea. Nobody seems to have any idea how this works except for a few scholars. And we're trusting them, I can tell you. So that's why I'm not going to lean on this too much. Because I think a lot of this Gilgamesh stuff is the fantasy of the scholars. But more on that later. And in your book, you have an example of it. See, it was done in clay tablets with a stylus and these wedges. And this whole thing was lost and is really not recovered until 100 years ago. But we now have something to predate the Bible. And for various reasons, people want to predate the Bible to show that it doesn't stand in isolation. Is there any influence of Babylonian culture today in America, as we sit here? And what time is it? 12 what? 12? 12? By 12? Who put the 12 up there? I do tens, don't you? Dollars? I got dimes? I got dollars? Base 10, remember base 10? Right? You know base 2 because of the computers, right? Zero on or off, 0, 1. What's with the 12? Who put the 12? 12 months? Right? The Babylonians used a base 12 number system. Okay? And it's stuck. It's still there. Okay? Pretty amazing. Right? Base 12. It's all I know. That's enough. All right. All right, back to page 2 and 3. So we have writing. Okay, that's as far as I want to go there. So then, let's look at the first page of this Gilgamesh. I'm going to do the 5-minute Gilgamesh. All right. It's actually a pretty interesting story about a really ruthless, horrible guy named Gilgamesh. Now, in your book, you only get part of it. You don't get the opening parts where he murders an awful lot of people, tortures an awful lot of people. This is all taking place in Mesopotamia and the land between the waters. You know, Baghdad or just north. It gets swampier. Traditionally, it got swampier the further south you go, okay, in Baghdad, in Iran. But Saddam Hussein actually drained the marshes. And he raped a lot of women. Okay, so he's a bad boy, this Gilgamesh. But he goes through a series of adventures, and which you don't get a lot of them in your selection. But by the end, he's getting philosophical. He's killed a lot of people. He's raped a lot of women. Why aren't I happy? He says. Well, the big one is, you know, because he realizes he's going to die. Like everybody. You can't keep it up. We'll get into that. and he decides to go visit a man who had the secret, he thought had the secret of long life. All right? And this guy is this Utanapishtim. Utanapishtim. Gilgamesh said to him, do you have page 18? Did I Xerox it? Okay. To Utanapishtim, the distant one, as I look upon you, Utanapishtim, your limbs are not different. You are just as I am. Indeed, you are not different at all. This is the first moment of diversity in world literature, okay? Which is what my project's all about. He's got, hey, you're just like me. I thought you were my enemy. I thought I could kill you with impunity, you know, and rape your women and, you know, but guess, you know, you're the same. Yet your heart is drained of battle spirit. You lie flat on your back, your arm idle. You then, how did you join the ranks of the gods and find eternal life? You know, it wasn't just the Spanish who tried to find the fountain of youth. Botox. Sci-fi. Okay. You know, you can laugh now, but when those first wrinkles come, you'll change your tune. All right. Everybody wants it, but you can't have it. And that's really what all, there's an awful lot of this literature about this problem, okay, of, you know, trying to get eternal life. Well, I think you might guess there's a solution coming, but we won't come up with it right now. Or a seeming solution, anyway. Well, he has this conversation with him, and it's the story of the flood. We're in the 11th tablet here. And I gotta say, your editors are being politically correct through everything, but they left out what used to be my classes liked the best, which was when Gilgamesh went to visit the harlot. Right? They liked that part, but that's gone. You have to go to the library to find it. But it's really interesting because I could do a great lecture on social customs and what behavior is expected of people. Okay. And you could make the argument from it that this is a book about the development of civilization too, about a dawning sense of right and wrong. See, Gilgamesh, murderer, rapist, but then it occurs to him when he starts thinking about death that maybe that was not so good. Maybe there's this sort of other standard he should be paying attention to. All right. Big realization. Okay. Saddam Hussein probably had the same thoughts. Good argument against the death penalty. Okay. Get him out there saying, hey, you know, I changed my mind. All right. Too late. Anyway, Utanapishtim says to Gilgamesh, I'm going to tell you about the story of the flood. And this is really hard. You know, you've got my handwriting on it if you've got the handout. But line 20 is the subterfuge. The gods all decide to flood the world, but they swear each other the secret. But this one guy, Eya, wants to let people know so that Uttanapishtim can build himself essentially an ark and float it out. So instead of telling him that would break the oath, he performs a trick. And most ancient literature deals with tricksters, okay, people who find clever ways to get around the rules. So he, instead of telling anybody, he tells a bunch of reed plants that there's going to be a flood. All right? But he's overheard, and so Uttanapishtim can build the ark. Now the reed plants are really fascinating. Line 21, reed fence, wall, wall, listen, O reed fence. Now this is the subterfuge that's mentioned in the footnote here. Because the southern part where the Tigris and Euphrates come together is the area that's known as Basra, which you now, I don't have to explain what it is because you all know. That's where the British are right now. The Americans are all north. And the area around Basra was all marsh until Saddam Hussein drained the marshes. And people lived on islands, very primitive. And there were wild boars there. And I mean, this is just 20 years ago. And a whole marsh society. It was sort of like the Louisiana Bayou. They lived in little skiffs around these islands. And anyway, drained the whole thing and moved all the people up to Baghdad. And that's who's sitting in Sadr City, in case you're wondering. These people are only there half a generation. Right? They were marsh dwellers, okay, who knew how to, you know, make rope out of reeds, had all the crafts, all gone. Right? So those reeds are really interesting. That's all I can say about it here. You notice that the ark he builds is measured in cubits. If you're a Bible reader, those cubits, 18 inches, the length of your forearm. That's how they used to measure things. And I'm going to have to... when the flood is over, they send out birds to see if there's land there. And just like the dove comes off Noah's ark and brings back a plant eventually. But I'm going to just jump right to one point. It's line 212. Just write that down if you don't have your book. 212. And it's the only thing I need for you to take out of this is that Gilgamesh is tested at the end, and there's two tests. One test is he's got to stay awake, and he fails to do that. And then he's got to pluck some giant plant, and he fails to do that. All right? And the question is, why is the test of this man, who's clearly about the dawning of ethics, about the dawning sense that there's a right and wrong out there, all right? Why is this first test given to him by, I'm pretty sure it's Uttanapishtim, all right, and says... who says to him in line 212, try not to sleep for 6 days and seven nights. See if you can stay awake. Can anyone guess why that's a test? I could do this for the whole thing, but I don't have time. We're not doing the whole thing. Right. What was his problem? What gave him the dawning sense of right and wrong? What gave Gilgamesh the dawning sense of right and wrong? What? Yeah, they might die. So why does this wise guy make his test that he should stay awake? Say that again.
If you stay awake that long, you feel like you're going to die.
You're getting there, yeah.
Sleep.
Yeah. They seem very similar. Right? If you can't stay awake for 7 days, you also will not be able to live forever. The sleep is a symbolic... transfer of death. That's the point I want to make. Literature is symbolic. The stuff that goes on is symbolic. You read it with an open mind. You say, you really do ask, what does it mean? And suddenly it's pretty cool. Now, am I right? Well, I don't know. Okay. But I think I'm right that it's symbolic. Whether I have the right answer, I don't know. I got one for you to think about till next Tuesday when we get to it. I got a dream of seven fat cows and seven lean cows. I'll say no more. You just figure that one out. Okay. I'm not going to tell you the answer. All right. In the meantime, by the way, if you want to read, this is a great movie. I will show you a bit of it next time. Seven Fat Cows. Any of you ever seen this? I don't know why. I love it. It's coming to Purdue. Yeah, get your tickets. Because the Pharaoh is like an Elvis imitator. It's funny. It's really funny. All right, so that's Gilgamesh. Now let's take a look at, that's all you get. I might as well say, what your anthology did was give you two translations. And translation is something I want you to think about in this class. Matter of fact, in the things to do, which is really only, you know, try and read the stuff. I realize you read it, you get lost. That's why you come to class, right? You know, I don't expect you to memorize it, but I think you should give it a shot before class, and certainly sometime after class. You know, at some point you have to sit down at your desk and read this stuff. All right? It does not come up on the TV. I got a little TV for you, but that's the best I can do. Right? And you want to read. You know, if you're like my kids, you have no place to read. Right? But you get a desk. You prop the book up at the proper angle, you know, so the eye is equidistant, right? You want a nice angle. I have a reading, I can make you a reading stand or something, or you can put something behind it. You know? Right? This is called reading, right? No, I mean, I know, my daughter went through college sitting on a bed, you know? She did everything cross-legged, right? It's like, I don't know. You're smarter than she is, right? Some of you probably know her. So I don't want to get into that. Anyway, they give you two translations. One was the literal, the one I was just reading, and then a more poetic one. So on page 31 is that test of the sleep, given a second time. So you want to look at those two passages. That's what you're bringing out of here. First pass this test. Just stay awake for 7 days. That's more comprehensible than the other one, which was a little tough. All right, but it's similarly symbolic, I think. And the poet brings out the translator whacks you over the head with the symbolism, which isn't there. He sort of plants it. Prevail against sleep, I'm on page 31, and perhaps you will prevail against death. See, it wasn't stated so boldly in the original, but the translator didn't want you to miss the point. This literalizing of symbolism is something that goes on in Bible translations all the time. Now, I don't have time in this class to bring in seven translations of the Bible, right? And I'm not trying to attack anybody's religion. Why not? It's America. We can attack each other's religion. But there are Bibles. One of them came door to door. That serpent at the beginning, you know, who tempts Eve. I mean, they just don't even call it a serpent. They just say it's Satan. Now, that's not in the Old Testament. Okay, you can interpret that serpent that way all you want. All right, but to take the word serpent out and put the word serpent in, that's injecting the symbolism. So let's take a look at the Old Testament. And we started with... you don't have it. We just saw it. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth, right? What happened on the next 7 days?
He created
stuff. What? Does anybody know? Look in your book. You can just open the book and let's do it. One. Heaven and earth, is that the deal? And he saw it was good, which is really interesting, because suddenly you're getting that injection of morality right away. Okay? Which is sort of slowly coming up in the Gilgamesh, but the Bible starts with a highly developed sense of what's of good and bad, which I take it is close to right and wrong. Right? What's the next thing? Well, I'll read it to you. God made the vault and it divided God said, let there be a vault in the midst of the waters, and let it divide water from water. And God made the vault, and it divided the water beneath the vault from the water above the vault, and so it was. And God called the vault heavens, and it was evening, and it was morning the second day. And you still don't know what happened the second day, do you? I just read it to you. What happened?
He created the land and the water.
What?
He created the land and the water.
No, he did that the first day.
Divided up
what?
Like he separated it?
He separated the waters. He divided the waters. Anybody care to explain what that means? I mean, this thing starts not so easy right away. There seem to be, up in heaven, waters above the firmament and waters below the firmament, if we even knew what a firmament was. Okay, there's some division of waters. And you can say the bottom water is the rain and stuff, but that means you have to project an outer sphere of water that the astronauts go through before they get to the moon. Wash off a little bit, you know. Nobody knows what that is. Okay, people work on this. Well, we'll leave it for now. But this division of the waters, something mysterious happened. All right. And I can't do all the biblical interpreters, but something was divided. It may just be the division itself. But I think it's hard to take it literally. It kind of means something. But let's get on to this. What happens the third day? The grass and the trees and the fruit. So, grass and plants. Wow, that was interesting. How about the fourth day? I mean, this is the foundation of many a civilization here, and like, you don't know this stuff? When you see President Jiske, you say, what happened on the second day? What's it got to do with cars? I don't know. So the fourth day, can you see it? Let there be lights in the vault of heavens to divide the day from the night, and they shall be signs for the fixed times and for years and days and years, and they shall be lights in the vault of the heavens to light up the earth. And God made two great lights, the great light for dominion of day and the small light for dominion of night, and the stars, and he placed them in the vault of the heavens to light up the earth. So basically, created the sun and moon. Now, does anything seem odd so far?
I always thought that the sun and moon came before the grass and plants.
Well, I would think I would put my sun up there first, I know. Yeah. But then I'm not God. All right? Because I want my plants to have a lot of sunlight. But he doesn't care. Okay? You tell me I'm making this up? The way you said it.
No, I always thought that the sun and moon came
forth. Yeah, well, it doesn't, does it? Comes forth. Okay? Anybody? So don't you feel the need to explain that?
Doesn't it like... talk about lights in the second one anyway. We're going to say dividing the water. So talking about...
You're in the wrong class. I'm so sorry.
Sit. Sit. Better late.
Light of
better
the
late
evening
than...
and light of the morning or something like that. I don't remember what it said.
Well, it says it was dark, and he said, let there be light on the first day. Oh.
Once he said it divided the light from darkness, he called those the
you're right.
Day, and, I mean, the light day and the darkness night.
Yeah.
So this is like changing over.
So maybe we should do it. So he divided the... Good for you. Okay. Does that look symbolic all of a sudden? The first 2 days are about dividing things up. You're in, you're out. You're dark, you're light. Okay. It's good. Okay. It's really intriguing. Anyway, so we divide the light, but there's no sun yet, is there? There's just light. Okay. Obviously, the photosynthesis does not depend on the light from the sun, but on some other source. Well, they didn't know about that. How about five? Yeah, anybody else? What do we get? Birds and fish. Six. Is it the sixth day we get the animals? Animals and man. In quotes, I want you to, when you're reading this, you want to look, and this doesn't do a great job, but does man include woman? Okay? There could be a double creation story here. The first time, it seems like human beings are created, but then you get later the story about the rib, about Eve being made from the rib. So that's a whole other thing that comes up. And maybe we'll look at it next time. And on the seventh day, what happens? What? Yeah, God rests. Okay. Well, why would you put the sun and the moon? I mean, what's the ordering principle here? See if we can. All right, quiz. I didn't have time to really do these things well, but what day is that? Good. Okay. Who's that? Who painted this? What? Somebody's got it. Michelangelo. This is the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Okay, it's the creation story. Which day is this? According to the Nuremberg Chronicle, I think it was 1480. Who was lost by the symbolism and decided to take it down to basics. Almost like a kind of mod. I know. I want you to guess. All right. It says here the third day of creation. Didn't want those plants and stuff in the way. Let me just remind you that there's this notion people have that people used to think the world was flat. You can ask probably 90% of the professors at Purdue in the Middle Ages and in the ancient time, people thought the world was flat. It's dead wrong. People always thought it was round. Okay. We all lived in the temperate zone. You couldn't get past the Sahara Desert to get to the southern hemisphere. But there are so many obvious proofs of the roundness of the Earth that ancient people knew about. The shadow of the Earth on the moon. It's round. Okay. When the ship goes out to sea, you can see the mass going down. That means there's a curve to the earth. And in, you know, the ancient Greeks actually figured out the circumference, you know, by taking the angles of incidence of the sun at the same time, two places 50 miles distant, and figuring out what the circumference is. And they had it, they knew better what the circumference of the earth was in ancient Greece than Columbus did, who was off by about 8,000 miles. Anyway, so just remember the Earth is round. Here's another set of illustrations. So day one, what's going on? Yeah, light and dark. That seems to be the universe. This is a medieval manuscript. The French kings just love to illustrate their manuscripts. So this is from a royal art workshop. All right. What's this? Yeah, he's got this problem with the waters. They're just wavy things, not sure what to do with it. What's that? Yeah, what is it? It's that birds and... When is, this must be five, huh? No, that's animals. That is a little mixed up. What?
Four animals.
What did you say?
Oh, well, he probably, like she said, combined the two, but that's day five. Okay. Four days.
So yeah, this stuff was confusing to people from, you know, all the time. Okay. Well, that one we can figure out. But here, for the day of creation, they've inserted the later story, which is comes a page or two later in Genesis about the creation out of the rib. And Professor Goodhart has a whole spiel on that, which you can listen to. What do you think's going on there? I know it's hard to see. I guess he's resting. So here's another version. Well, there's the birds. Here's some plants. Actually, that looks like this. No. Day four?
Sun and moon. Star.
Oh, yeah. Sun and moon. Right. Good. Okay. I'll bet that's day two. And I think that's the seventh day. And there's everybody's favorite scene. I think we've seen that. This is actually a little later. This is God showing Adam around, naming the animals. And this actually says it's the naming of the animals. I'm not sure how all these people got in there on day six. I'll tell you how they got in there. If you're working for the French king in 1350, the meaning, what it means for Adam to name the animals is ideological. It meant that Adam had control over the animals because he could give them names. Right? Now my big point here is just that it's symbolic and people are doing their interpreting. Right? And everybody does it. You can do it, I can do it. Right? But if you're working for a French king, control is the issue, isn't it? The king isn't really that worried about controlling animals. He does that all the time. It's controlling you that counts, the people. So here is a king controlling the people. The symbolic meaning of day six, according to a French artist of 1350, was it showed the divine source of the king's power to control people. This is why we had the American Revolution. Okay. Here are those kings. All right. This is actually I don't know if they put it in. There's the cat. There are four rivers in paradise, and that's the four rivers there. People just love these biblical scenes. Okay, so you notice I'm reading the Bible through other people. This is anybody guess where that is? Those are mosaics. See that kind of round capital? You know your Greek architecture? You got a Corinthian column here, but this rounded capital, that's definitely an Arabic influence. Okay, and this is from Palermo in Sicily, built about 1050, where you had a very heavy Arabic presence. This is one of the most stunning churches in the world, but you can see Adam and Eve and the creation of Eve and biblical stories all over the place. Well, here's another set. Okay, light and dark, waters. Day three, quick, what is it? What? Grass and plants, sun and moon, lots of birds, animals jumping around. This guy seems to be making sense. Here begins Incipit liber Bereshit. Oh, that is so fascinating. Id est Genesis. Well, I don't have to explain that to you. I know. In Kippit, here begins. Incipient, our word is. Can you read that? Oh, wait a minute. I have my Christmas present. Oh, I don't have it. It's stuck down there. I got those $5 laser pointers. Best thing I ever got. Next class, I'll have it. Here begins the book Bereshit. You ever heard that word before? You did. You just heard it about 15 minutes ago. Where was it? It was... Yeah, the first word, that's Professor Goodhart's first word. And he started reading, and I put it up there. I guess it was in Hebrew. Bereshit, okay, which means in the beginning. And the first thing he said to me was, it doesn't mean in the beginning, right? And if I turn to this modern translation, I don't have the phrase in the beginning. I have when God began to create heaven and earth, which is really problematic as far as I'm concerned, but he wants to get away from this notion of beginnings, because beginnings raise all sorts of problems philosophically. So here begins the book of Bereshit. Id est, that is. That's Latin, right? Genesis. What the Hebrews called, the book the Hebrews called Bereshit, we call Genesis. So Genesis is the Latin word. You getting this down? I'm not kidding about this stuff, right? It's not like overwhelming, but little facts help you build up your mind and to know things, okay? Genesis is a Latin word. The genesis of the problem. Genetics, okay? Genes. Little building blocks. And it just means first. Okay, first book, or origins, or something like that. Okay, but the Hebrews didn't call the book Genesis; they called it Bereshit. They named the book after the first word in it, because they weren't reading a book, were they? By the way, what were they reading? A scroll. Okay. Through all this period, everything's a scroll. The turning book is a rather medieval notion. Things are written in scrolls. It's a huge breakthrough, isn't it, to have a book? Because it's random access. Right? You can open it to any part instantly. Where the scroll, you have to scroll through it to find it. Right? Anyway, so Genesis in principio, that's the Latin for in the beginning. Creavit Deus, God created, okay. Chelum, the heavens, and the Teram, the earth. Okay. Let's see what else we got. Okay, so that's enough of that. Alright, so what do I want you to do for Thursday? I think the first thing is show up. That always helps. I know you fall behind and stuff. But you should give it a shot to read this stuff. Now you can see there's an awful lot of stuff here. I can just say, well, go read Gilgamesh and show up on the exam and I'll ask you something. Right? And if you want to live dangerously, be my guest. Right? But what we're trying to do is focus on a few things and so that you'll remember them. And the symbolic nature of the sleep and the death, I think, is easy enough to remember. But you should go back and have a read, because it's a reading course. Right? I know it's difficult. It's just when you're tired and you get home, it's easier to put on the movie. But here, you got to get a book. And first, you got to buy the book. And then you got to carry it to class. And I apologize for that. But, you know, do the curls or something. Right? All right? And I also suggest that you should look up every day, get one sentence in a different translation. Just be conscious of that translation. So do that. Keep a notebook. Keep a record of those. I'll look at them sometimes. Sometimes I won't. All right? But you should do it. There's two places to get other translations. There's this thing called the library over there. All right? And you can just walk in there and pull something off the shelf. If you want to use the internet for that, absolutely fine with me. All right. And all this stuff, there's so much on the internet out there that if it's too much, it'd be overwhelming if you leave your studying just to surfing the internet. It's so much more convenient to just sort of show up here and take a few notes. Okay. And there you go. See you Thursday. Yeah, well,
so
you don't want to do that again.
Room,
are there any other syllabuses? Did you get this?
Yeah, I've got them.
Okay.
I just wanted to apologize.
Okay, so you're never going to miss again.
No, I won't.
Yeah, go ahead. All right, and all right.
This is the copy that they had at the bookstore when I went, and I'm guessing this is not the one that's supposed to have.
That's right.
Okay.
Shit. Excuse my friend.
I can go change it. Follett's at Pretty West. This is what they had. And I'm noticing it's completely
Did
different.
You see that one there?
This right. is the only thing
Western literature, that's for all masterpieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they had like on the sign or something. It was really weird. But I can switch this out. I just want to make sure that...
Okay. If they have this. I'm sure they're not going to. If they don't, just bring a Bible or something to follow along.
I have my one with all my notes.
Okay. All right.
I'm Kelly.
Oh, you're the... Right. Hang on.
I have a full surgery schedule on Thursday, so that will be here.
All right. I will try and tape it, okay?
I mean,
there's no penalty, but
okay.
I understand people have these things. Okay. So,
yeah.
and you'll be able to access it through my homepage, the courses, and you'll see the whole syllabus. You go to the date.
Yeah.
I can, but sometimes, like, it doesn't work. All right.
So just mainly, like, the next Tuesday, just keep up with reading?
Yeah, next Tuesday is the end of Genesis, story of Joseph. I'm going to watch this. Go ahead. All right. Thank